This podcast may contain strong language and potentially sensitive themes. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Hello, and welcome to the Talking Theatre podcast, the podcast for you if you love all things theatre. I'm Luke.
And I'm Tom.
And each episode we get together to chat to theatre professionals, emerging theatre artists, and lovers of theatre in general.
Now, to put it very simply, our podcast aims to celebrate why theatre's so great with people that love theatre.
Exactly, and this week will be no different. And coming up, there'll be some of this.
And so I called myself a sound designer before I even touched Q-Lab. They're looking for a sound designer. I was like, yeah, me, I know sound design. I knew nothing.
There'll also be a bit of this.
It took me a long while to sort of get to understand that it really isn't about getting to the end of the show. It's about the first 10 minutes and whether you get the first 10 minutes right.
And even this.
The joy of making theatre really is you making together. And if it's a room that doesn't allow you to make together, then you might not want to go back to the same room ever again. And that's okay. You know, you have to pick your rooms and you pick your crowd.
So all that's left to say is thank you for tuning into this episode of the Talking Theatre podcast. And, well, let's get on with the show.
Hi, mate. How are things? We've got some good news to report this week, I believe.
Yeah, no, I'm very well. Yeah, I was going to say, got some good news. So, I mean, we've been sitting on this for a while. I'm pretty sure I knew about this when we were doing series one, but I couldn't actually say anything.
Yes, pretty much. Yes.
Or at least at the end of series one. But we've got a play on.
We have. We've
got a play on in November at the old Lion and Unicorn. It's really weird now that I'm allowed to announce it. I don't know what to say. But yeah, it's called Blue Bottles. It's an absurd tragicomedy. We're doing a read-through very soon, and rehearsals are kicking off. It's exciting.
It is very exciting.
Yeah, and it's with Periphery Theatre, the company I set up with Megan Bassnett. I mean, if you want to come and check out what we're doing outside of the podcast, by all means, come along. I feel like I'm doing a little plug for ourselves. It's great.
Well, it is great because, you know, for the past couple of weeks, we've been chatting to other emerging theatre artists that have been having performances on, and we have our very own here. So, you know, now is your time, Tom, to sell
now
your show.
Time to shine. Well, yeah, I mean, come along by all means. 4th to the 7th of November, later on this year. It's called Blue Bottles, and it's at the Lion Unicorn Theatre, and tickets will be on there. Also, if you follow me on Periphery Theatre, the tickets are all on there as well. It's very exciting news.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what is also exciting is today's guest.
Somebody
that we commented on this, I think, in the interview about how excited we were to kind of chat to this guest and go into an area that has always kind of fascinated us both, I think, in terms of that element, without giving too much away at this stage, of that element of something that you don't see, you kind of only hear. But when you really start to listen in and tune in and hear it, you start to understand how important it is to the play. And as I kind of hinted at the start of last week's episode when I was doing my review of Romeo and Juliet, about how important the sound was to that play, today is an opportunity to really delve into why sound is so great and chat to someone who is one of the most incredible emerging sound designers and composers in the country. So without further ado, please enjoy our chat with Nicola T. Chang.
Our guest this week is Nicola T. Chang. Nicola is a composer and sound designer for stage and screen. She is a member of the 2020-21 Old Vic 12 cohort as a composer and sound designer, the BFI and BAFTA crew as a film composer, and a composer and musical director attached to British Youth Music Theatre UK. As a performer, she has played for Six in the West End as Deputy MD in Keys One, and is a former cast member of Stomp in the West End and World Tour. She has performed with the Chineke Orchestra, the Women of the World Orchestra, and the London Film Music Orchestra, and at venues such as the Royal Albert Hall, the Royal Festival Hall, and the Shakespeare's Globe. In 2017, she conducted the London Film Music Orchestra, playing her original soundtrack to The Perfect Dinner, accompanied by a live film screening, and premiered her concerto for ping pong and piano trio at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in January 2019. And this concerto was performed in Shanghai later in the year. She has worked in a variety of theatres, including the RSC, the Almeida Theatre, Theatre Royal Bath, the Orange Tree Theatre, and the Royal Court, to name literally but a small handful. And her breadth of work is truly breathtaking. And we have Nicola with us today. So hi, Nicola, how are you doing?
Hello, hi. It's nice to be here today. Thank you so much for having me. Well, thank you. It's a Tuesday afternoon. I have a cup of coffee in my hand and I'm doing really well.
That's a very good morning, to be fair.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we always start with a very simple question, but what is your earliest memory of theatre? Did you enjoy it or was it just sort of a weird experience?
My earliest memory of theatre was probably kindergarten when we did Snow White and then I was the narrator for some unknown reason. And then, so imagine a bunch of really young kids trying to sing their way through this staged version of Snow White for their parents.
Yeah.
And then I think I got so fed up with the singing that I went backstage and sang into the god mic. And then, and then every time I sang, the teachers backstage would just laugh. And so me being 3 years old would stop singing. And then they would just keep egging me on and so I'd start singing again. And so I think my understanding of the show was that I had some kids on stage singing and the narrator backstage just going, la, 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 singing a bit louder.
Yeah.
Like, so that was my earliest memory of theatre, actually. Wow. I know, it's a very bizarre one. And I still remember it every now and then. It comes to haunt me. But I also, the one that it's more career related, is I first saw a video of Stomp Out Loud when I was 7. So I grew up playing percussion and my teacher showed me that video and I thought, wow, that is the coolest thing possible. It makes a bunch of people really sweaty and grimy and looking like they're having a fantastic time slamming a broomstick on stage. What else do you want in life? So that was sort of something that became quite a fixation for me was, oh, wow, I really want to play or join the show. So that is my other earliest theatre memory is film theatre. I grew up in Hong Kong. I didn't go to see a lot of theatre, but I did do a bunch of youth Shakespeare things. I've done Macbeth 3 times. I was Ross, Banquo and Macduff. So, yeah.
Oh, I mean, normally our second question is sort of is there a point that led to the career in theatre? And obviously kindergarten might be a little bit early to be sort of questioning early, yeah, that. But is it that Stomp moment, watching Stomp and thinking, that's the sort of thing I want to get involved in? Or is that just sort of an inspiration spark, being like, oh, I want to try that more, and then a career decision came later, or?
I think it's mainly the latter. So I did economics and international relations at uni, and I thought I was going to be a consultant, and music was always going to be a side hobby. I was going to probably go to a jazz cafe in the weekend, holiday. And then I moved to London from Hong Kong, and then I always secretly wanted to see if I could join the show, actually. Mm. And then I watched the show once in town in the West End. I thought, okay, well, you know what? This is probably really is for me. I really, really need to give it a shot. And so I auditioned for the show a few years after I moved here. So yeah, and then went from a desk job in a music company to training for the show, to doing a completely different thing, to having to confront your own, because your own anxieties and demons when you're on stage as a performer. And then, I had many times to reconsider, being like, oh, this might not be for me. But, thinking back how happy that gig made me, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a career thing. And theatre is such a multifaceted thing. It's not just about enjoying my time on stage, it's enjoying the connection, it's enjoying the play, enjoying the playmaking, enjoying the presentation and enjoying that instance, that moment in time when everybody within this one building is focused on one moment and one thing they hear. And that was what sort of, when I started doing it, I was like, oh, this is really, really for me, is just, yeah, is that kind of playmaking.
So in terms of the journey then from that point, Nicola, can you just talk a little bit more about what that kind of stage was between then to now? Like, how has that kind of played itself out in terms of, where that's kind of come from, you being on stage in that show to now talking to us?
So I've always wanted to write music for film. The other thing is, I really, when I was growing up, my favorite film was Star Wars, but only purely because I love the Princess Leia theme. No other reason. I just loved it. And the Yoda theme and all the themes, the asteroid theme. Oh man, John Williams is such a genius. And so I really wanted to get into writing music for film. When I was in Stomp, there was sort of like a nighttime gig. So in the daytime, I went on Mandy.com and hunted for composing jobs. For some reason, theatre was easier. Theatre is, I think, a slightly easier to get into than is film in London. And so I called myself a sound designer before I even touched QLab. They're looking for a sound designer. I was like, yeah, me. I know sound design. I knew nothing. But I went on there and just put a bunch of sound effects into iTunes players and called it a day, and then self-taught myself QLab and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then got really lucky, I think, to be able to have the privilege and to afford to do a few pub gigs, pub theatre gigs where they were massively underpaid, but put me into contact with some really fantastic people who then put my name forward. Mm. And then it sort of snowballed from there. There were some really fantastic opportunities that I was lucky to have, and I was able to showcase different, like, my work in really great ways. And then also slowly developing a specialism, I think, and finding my place within the sound design and composition niches in the UK theatre industry. And yeah, so it started with a few pub theatre gigs. I was once too big for my boots. I once went from a pub theatre gig to a gig at a bigger building and then did terribly on that. Almost wanted to quit. So this is the one thing I also will always do is I will always play my sound effects quite at a low volume, because when I first went into that theatre, someone's on the ladder, two-story high ladder, putting something in the petrol drop. And then I dragged in the sound effect into QLab. It played really loud. He almost fell off. And he's like, never do that ever again. And I went, I'll never do that ever again. And so, yeah. And so every time I put any sound effect in it, people usually ask me to bump it up because I'm just like perpetually scared of knocking someone off a ladder.
Overly cautious.
Massively overly cautious. But, you know, it gives you room to go. And yeah, so I was too big for my boots in some of the projects. But I think the main thing was I called myself a composer and sound designer before I actively thought I should be one. Yeah. And so pub theatre gigs, and then always kept performing on the side though, because I feel like in my practice as a musician, everything cross informs. So if I play in Stomp or if I play in Six, the musical, being on stage lets me see audiences react quite immediately. And there's a different kind of connection than sitting in the audience and listening to my own sound design, you know, because that's more of a backseat. That's where it's contemplative rather than quite an immediate, like, I'm going to grab attention right now. And so I think it's very important. And for me, as who I am, you know, working in the industry, to keep my feet wet. Is that the expression? I think dip my toes in many things and keep my feet wet.
Yes.
I know where you're going from with that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and then I did a lot of festivals. So Vaults Festival was a big thing that I usually do a lot of shows there as an Edinburgh Fringe Festival, because the footfall is really high. And then over lockdown, started venturing off to audio drama and then on podcasts because theatres were closed. And so found new love in that, found new developing a different kind of, you know, sound and language for those things as well. And so here I am, just picking, choosing projects, having had done a few fantastic ones, and then getting faster at my work, but also getting hopefully more of a sonic brand as well, hopefully, is what I'm trying to get to at this point.
And you said, I mean, it sounds like it feels really strange. I've got some friends who have just gone up to Edinburgh Fringe this year, and I don't know how it's any different or anything, but I'm excited to hear what they say. But in terms of Edinburgh Fringe, you said Vaults as well. Were you doing sort of more than one show at a time, or were you just going one each year, or sort of as many as you can at once?
As many as I can. I mean, there was one week where in Vaults, I think in 2019, where I did 3 or 4 shows in the week, and that was bad. Like, never, I would not recommend it. I would not recommend it. But the problem was, I was starting out, I was like, I'll take anything. I will take any opportunity. And the funny thing is, if you actually went to all these shows that week, you'll hear that some of the things are being reused. So I reused some of my, like, really intimate drones, or quiet moments and all these focusing bits. Apologies to those who now know. Yeah, so I would sort of just, since I was there anyway, I was in the same location in London. I just trying to get as many shows out there as possible and get as much footfall and get as much people listening and knowing sort of the name. That was genuinely what I wanted to do. Fringe as well, Edinburgh Fringe, I once did 4, I think, which is, again, I would not recommend. But I mean, and the irony of that, isn't it? That you look back and you go, oh, wow, it was tough, but that got you to where you are, so.
Yes. Yeah, it's one of those things you never recommend someone else does, but it did help at the time, but it's a difficult line to balance. Would you say, so you said 4 in Edinburgh Fringe, is that over the whole Fringe or is that in 1 week?
Over the whole Fringe, but we had to check everything in 1 week. Yeah, so it was, so I went to different texts, and some of them were at 10 p.m., some of them were at 8 a.m. and walking over. It was quite hilly as well, wasn't it?
Edinburgh is quite hilly.
Walking back and forth. Yeah, I mean, you know, no matter what I say, I wouldn't recommend it. At the time, it did help, and at the time, it was quite a career boost. And you're just doing this thing where I just retweet everybody's comments, and yeah, just kind of that excitable, like, yeah, well, this is me. So I'm gonna, anybody says anything that involves the word sound on the show, and I'm like, gonna retweet it because. And all the reviews. So yeah, I think part of it was just being kind of like social media savvy as well, a little bit to a certain extent.
Yeah, I feel that's definitely a big part of the theatre world now, understanding social media, which is very much a learning curve, because I've never been massive on it myself, and trying to learn how to do it very quickly is an interesting one. So when you say you're doing this many shows at once and just sort of getting your name out there, trying to get as much experience and vary and so on, are you attending all the rehearsals, or are you sort of being given a brief and then sort of sent away and then you come back and sort of take part here and there? Or are you very much active in the rehearsal room with the actors and director and maybe potentially a writer as well, all that going on at the same time?
I think I did that for all different shows in different capacities. I usually try, in my process, I usually try to go to the read-through, because for me, it just, I like to hear things out loud rather than read things on the page. And then some shows where sound is quite an active part, particularly for shows where actors rely on sound to move, or they motivate them, or for just scene change, they need to hear the button, they need to hear that, and we'll probably go to rehearsals quite a lot. And then put in a draft sound design, a skeleton of it, and then drop it off for stage manager, just so it just speeds the process up. And then I'll go home and tweak things. I'll go to maybe one rehearsal a week until the last week, and then there'll be 2 days probably popping in and out, trying things out.
Yeah.
It's important to get the palette right, and that's took me a long while to sort of even get to understand that it really isn't about getting to the end of the show. It's about the first 10 minutes and whether you get the first 10 minutes right in a sound designer, if there's a lot of sound design in it. Because if you get to the end and it's not right, you just redo everything. So it's actually more constructive. Even in the third week when you don't have everything yet, to bring in all that you have and know that you're in the right track. So yes, setting the palette down.
And obviously, like I said, like Edinburgh Fringe is very different this year, and the festivals in general are all very changeable currently. And you mentioned sort of exploring a new realm of theatre and audio dramas and podcasts and so on. What's been your experience of that? It's not been a quick change, because obviously those things have always been around and they've been going on for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
But the very sudden rush to a lot of people switching to radio dramas and podcasts and that sort of format. What's been your experience of that shift?
I think for me personally, my skills were very transferable, which was really great. The shift was primarily making sure that my design direction worked, because I, as a sound designer and composer, I tend to be quite musical, coming from, I trained as a musician, and so I end up using a lot of quite musical drones, or quite musical, I use a lot of strings, I use a lot of piano in my work, and for example, Wild Through Nothing that you heard, Tom, that was, there was musical in it, you know, the fox was a little flute lick, and so trying to justify that, and trying to find a way to get, you know, to justify the fox being a flute moment, you actually have to go all the way back to the start of the audio play and then use that to introduce the whole piece so that people have that in their ears. So yeah, it was sort of transferring the idea that as a designer, I'm looking at things on stage, in a stage show, and then peppering things in and then developing them so that each sound sort of has a story, and then transferring that into audio drama. Yeah, but justifying musicality within usually scripts that appear naturalistic has been the most difficult part for me, I think. But then saying that, I feel like once you justify it, it just gives you so much room to go. There's so many places you can go to. That sounds like there's so many places you can go. But honestly, I think if you're able to set some design rules in the start and musicalize sound effects, you know, the waves could be musicalized, the boat crashing onto shore could hit on the downbeat of your musical track, and all these bits are just lovely finessing that you get to do because it's a static piece of work. It's been incredibly rewarding, much like scoring for film, but slightly different.
I was gonna say it must be very similar to an element of film in terms of you've got the product in front of you constantly and you can sort of tweak and change wherever you need to. And it's not live and constantly going out.
Yeah, and beat as well. So beats, you know, the voice talent could record themselves saying something really quickly, and then as a sound designer, I go, but hang on, there needs to be a story beat here. So kind of even more, there's a slight, almost like, you know, obviously I confer the director first, but there's a slight directorial liberty I can take that I can't ever have on stage. I can't go to the actor and go, take a beat so my sound effect can land, right? I can, but also, no, I mean, come on. So yeah, and being able to do that. But the audio drama process has very much been writer and the director and the sound designer sort of tackled on the very end. So the process becomes quite reactionary. I was recently commissioned to do a piece by 45 North where I was the lead artist on it. So now sound designer and then attached a writer and then probably a director on it, which was quite a very rewarding process, because now I'm thinking about if I put a Zoom recorder inside a tin, and then if you open the tin, that does something to the different sound qualities you hear. So for me, wow, sonic environment is a way of storytelling. It's a way of journeying from location A to location B that a writer might not necessarily coming from their writing background think. So it's been, I think it's been really, really fun to do a design piece of letter work in July as well, when I'm thinking about binaural heads and I'm thinking about sonic environments and listening to a conversation through a Skype screen or through a Zoom screen, because that has a particular way of compression. So these things excite me. I'm like, oh, these are very tangible sound events that when you put in a certain order, tell a certain chronological story.
Absolutely. And something you touched on earlier was about that career development and taking those Edinburgh gigs and those Vault Festival ones as part of that career development. And I just wanted to now touch on, if you don't mind, something that I'm sure has been also extremely good for your career development. And that is your part in this year's or last year's, whichever way you want to put it, Old Vic 12.
Yeah, so, Old Vic 12, yeah.
Yes. So if people have listened to our first series, we had Poppy Corbett on, who was one of the playwrights on this year's or last year's Old Vic 12. But I just wanted to hear from your perspective, actually, Nicola, what your experience was like being part of that group and how important you think that that group has been for you in terms of development, but also now moving forward to the next stage of your career.
Sure. Also, shout out to Poppy. She's amazing. Poppy's an amazing writer. Yeah. Love you, Poppy. Massive love. I think first and foremost, I met such amazing friends from the program. I think we are all very driven creatives who have always been making our entire lives and are getting together to make. And the best thing about it is stretching myself across three different shows. So Poppy's show is Fake Melania. And so as a sound designers, we've got sound designer, we've got movement director. I've also got a designer. And the three of us work almost horizontally across all the shows. And so because these three shows are so different, they demand different design languages. And there was the most rewarding bit is trying to think about, okay, well, I can't do the same thing for all three stage shows. You just can't, right? There's one show, if I just do underscoring and then this and that for all shows, then I'm not, number one, it's not tailored to the show. And number two, it's not really challenging myself. So the rewarding bit has been finding the essence of each show sound-wise and music-wise and then pushing forward with it. For example, for Fake Melania, for me, it was, okay, well, instead of having great scene change music, because why? How about if the scene change were just a snare drum and different snare drum beats and different snare drum patterns? Because the payoff is so high. The snare drum does a role and then it grows into some other song at the very end of the piece. That's a very high payoff. Whereas, for example, with another piece called Genealogy, when I was like, okay, well, I'm going to strip it all the way back. It's just only going to be mics and loop pedals. And because the piece inherently is about, to a certain extent, about performers taking their own agency, I almost feel like they have to take agency over the sound design. And so enabling that and then creating sound design that is just, you know, pressing spacebar and cue that activates Ableton and blah, blah, blah. But then in the end of the day, they make their own sound effect and it just plays back, right? And so the show's different every single night. So that's very fun. And then for Gobble, 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 Goblin, which is a I think the lens which I view it in terms of design is quite filmic. So it's big, it's cavernous, it's got all these different worlds in it. And so therefore that is the piece where I exercise the most, I guess, you know, orchestral scores or bits and bobs. So yeah, the thinking across horizontally across three and using different design languages and tools available. And that's a fantastic challenge, meeting great creators. I was also connected to Ben and Max Ringham, who are my mentors, because there's a mentorship team. I thought I'm going to get two for the price of one. So I got both Ringhams, but aged enemies. And so that was just really great because I have always been a fan of their work, but primarily been a fan of their ideas, their idea process and their generative process and the way they pitch and the way their ideas are like fresh, but also supportive. And bold. And so that's what I wanted to learn. I think as an emerging sound designer, a lot of the times I'm just kind of, I feel like I'm a bit tentative in my approach and ideas. And now I'm getting better at sort of even participating in the dramaturgy of a piece because I'm a sound designer, but I'm also creative. And my voice is equally valid in a horizontal theater space. But yeah, so building almost like confidence in design and confidence in presentation has been great, and I've learned a lot from both of them. And so I am very grateful for being part of the program, even though COVID has been a tough, tough year.
Yeah,
here we are.
It was great to chat to Poppy as well, hearing just because it was obviously earlier this year. There's been obviously a lot of time between then and now in terms of OV12 and the developments and everything, but it's been very interesting just to hear more about it, really. You said something really interesting just there, which is something that I wanted to sort of briefly touch upon, was you said that as a sound designer, you have just as much right to say and give creative opinions and so on. Is that something that you thought when you were sort of starting out back in the earlier days of your sound design that you felt that you couldn't do? And is it something that you, because it sounds sort of one of those things that you really should be pushing, as like a everyone should have creative vision and so on, but it's obviously not like that in the industry, as everyone will know. But is that something that you struggle with at the start, or is it something that's it's now changing? And
I think it's such a it's personally changing for me, because I'm taking more agency and taking and being just more vocal in the room. When I first started out, I mean, there was this inherent hierarchy, I suppose, in my head. Directors, you know, and it all depends on the room and how horizontal it is. I've been in rooms where that is absolutely, you just walk into the room, you know, it's not encouraged. I've been in rooms where I know that it's encouraged. I've been particularly in a lot of Zoom rooms where I know, you know, where I'm going to raise my hand and say something. Because it is more effective for you to say something and raise something out now than it is for someone to rip it to shreds later, a few weeks down the line on stage. You know, they rip it to shreds and you're like, oh man, I kind of wish I said that. And also, there are a lot of things, I think my experience is there are a lot of sound can do so much storytelling that not necessarily linguistically writers or directors may have in their arsenal or can maybe hear or / visualize. And then that's when I go, wait, no, you don't actually need that paragraph. You don't actually need the story beat. Or I could just do that for you, you know. I could show once where it's about two characters take up a lot of space on stage, right? The show's about them taking up space. And then once they leave the stage, and whenever they're on stage, I put in this really slight hum, electrical hum, that's quite annoying, very, very subtle. And when they leave finally for good, I just take that hum away. And then the room just goes, you can almost hear the room go, but it's been there all the time and you just get so attuned to it. But then, you know, what that is a design language that not necessarily you, a director or writer, might have in their heads. And I go, well, what if that? And then you don't have to, then you know, you can communicate so much more. Or I'm using a lot of bass subwoofer rumbling or a bit of tinnitus at the end to signal something and then playing into how we understand sound. Yeah, but back to the question, I think I'm just being a bit louder now because my voice is valid, but also because this is what the joy of making theatre really is, you're making together. And if it's a room that doesn't allow you to make together, then that's, you might not want to go back to the same room ever again. And that's okay. You know, you have to pick your rooms and you pick your crowd.
Yeah, because would you say then that it's potentially a more beneficial environment to have everyone have a say and really let everyone be as creatively involved as possible? Would you say that on the general whole, that's definitely a route that should be taken slightly more?
Yeah, I think it depends. I mean, I understand that for larger scale productions, that has a different kind of bearing. But I started with a lot of small pub theatre gigs where the team is small and the room is kind. So those I will miss a lot and always kind of hold very dear. And yeah, I mean, I think most of my best work is made in a room that is quite horizontal and in which I'm not reacting, but I'm initiating and I'm proposing and motivating. I think you are in the room for a reason, and it takes a while for that confidence to come in, but you're in the room for a reason and you should grab onto that and then use your voice as loud as you possibly can. You know, it's you never, because your life experiences also bring something on. You never know if something on stage is going to potentially do something for other people watching it. And, you know, your life experiences will help inform the right and wrong choices. But I think it also needs to, and unfortunately needs to start with the room. It needs to start with what culture there is in that room. And it needs to start with whether you understand that your opinion will be valued or not. And I've been in rooms where once you walk in, you go, right, yeah, sure. Okay, I'll just keep quiet and stand in the corner and do what you want me to do. Whereas there'll be rooms where I've been asked, oh, what about this, what about that? And I go, oh yeah, no, what about this, what about that? And it's quite interesting. And I used to admire designers who could even talk about dramaturgy and story beat. And now I'm like, oh no, you know what? You should talk about dramaturgy and story beat too. It takes time though, I think, you know, because I didn't go to drama school or anything. Dramaturgy is still something I'm still learning.
Yeah.
But hopefully getting better.
I think the best place to learn those sort of things is just on the job, mostly. It's very hard to do a job in the creative arts or anything in that sort of vein. You can't really learn it from a textbook. It's very hard to sort of sit and read about all these things. And that's just getting in a room and trying it is the best way to do it.
You have to learn by doing things, which is why when opportunities come, you sort of grab them, because that's the best way to learn. And by watching, I feel like I also used to be able to, you know, another thing about fringe festivals or vault festivals, you always watch so much. Yeah. And for me as a sound designer, watching sort of trends. Watching, you know, what other people are doing, but also what are the trends of sound and storytelling that has been really fascinating. I feel like when I work with directors who may be of an older generation, their understanding of sound to tell story is very different from a lot of younger directors. And that's what I've noticed. Often older generation directors, sound is very gestural. You have one drum beat, you have one this, one that, develop that throughout. Whereas some shows now seem to call for quite an immersive sound design, very almost all-encompassing, filmic, big, roaring sound design. And they're both very valid and both equally amazing ways of telling story with sound and music. It's just something that I was picked up and I went, ah, that's interesting. And I would recommend learning both experiences because, yeah, because sound sometimes is gestural. Like, you know, with Shakespearean or ancient Greek Grecian theatre, it's very much, oh, they are going to battle, kadook, rather than all this mass of crowd sounds at the back. And you're like, well, that's a film then, isn't it?
So you touched on it briefly earlier in terms of music and especially sort of the Painkiller podcast, so on the merging of music and sound effects and so on. But since you sort of started off wanting to compose music for film and along that sort of vein, do you tend to take more liberty than other sound designers necessarily on music in terms of sound effects and so on? And is that sort of developed into have you got a certain style or a niche that you sort of really, really tap into in that regard?
Yeah, I think all my designs are in a key, and this is really, I don't think a lot of people notice that, but so when there are light moments and when it calls for it, I usually put quite a light, maybe slightly major chord pad on the top. And then a lot of my sound designs, and I have a bank of just sine waves that are of certain notes, and I just assemble them into different chords, but very subtly, and they change through different scenes. And so, yeah, and this helps scene change music, because if this scene is in the key of B and your scene change music is in the key of B, is very satisfying. And then the key of B goes to the relative minor of, oh, I don't know, G sharp minor, B major, G sharp minor. And that's also very satisfying because everything just seems so connected and so well thought out. So yeah, let's think stylistically, and I don't usually say it out loud, but all my pieces have a key. And I think about it like a piece of filming underscore, where in the film, when you're working on Logic Pro or Pro Tools, for example, you just easily just press a key on your keyboard and go. But then in theatre, you have to really orchestrate on QLab. So my shows tend to be quite big, and you see a lot of cues running. You're like, why are the cues running? It's just this an F sharp and D sharp and a B at the top, just like doing its thing very, very, very softly, but holding space so that you can go to another key later in another scene. So yeah, that is sort of stylistically what I do.
That's really interesting. And you know, you often hear the question posed to directors about, do you have a through line in your work? And I think it's really interesting to kind of hear a similar type of question being discussed with designers. So if people haven't yet worked out why sound design and musical accompaniment is so crucial to the outcome of a show, in your own words, what would you say as to why sound is so important? And is it something that you think is going to become even more prevalent actually as theatre develops over these next few years?
Right, sound and music in theatre are important because it captures something that is in a language, whether it's a visual language or maybe it's spoken in English, and then it translates everything into something that's a universally spoken language. I think I learned more than ever that on Stomp, because that is a show where it's just purely music and there's no dialogue, and yet you're telling story through hitting pipe against the wall and bringing gags back. And it's very visual, very much relying on, you know, big performances, but also it's universal, right? That's why it's such a great world tour show, because you can go to anywhere in the world and you get it. I feel like sound and music does that too in the theatre piece, when if it calls for that, it will take the emotion of a scene and propel you to the emotion of the next scene in a language that's absolutely universal. I think we as audiences understand sound and music quite universally, and we understand what this key means and what the sound effect does to us and does to the action. That's why it's important, and that's why I love it so much, and that's why it's great to hear and listen out for unique takes or gestural things. I was watching a piece last Wednesday, where the sound designer put in a massive, like quite a loud drone underneath a whole scene, and then when it was taken out, it was just so jarring, and that was a gesture, and that was a deliberate dramaturgical choice, and I was like, ah, that is great. So it does that. It's not just tone. It's that it does story beats. It fills space. It takes up space. The absence of sound says something. As to the same question, I don't know yet, because I've only done this for a few years, so I can't really comment on it. I think I'm seeing a lot more sound. I understand that sound design is quite a relatively, in terms of, as compared to other design disciplines, quite a relatively new one. And sound design is also one that where the technologies, you always have to sort of catch up on technologies. So yeah, I just can't wait to see more shows and listen to different sound design. And also, I really don't know. Hopefully we'll see theatre where all the design languages come into play. And I would actually quite like to see more design than theatre as well. I'm interested in what the story of a costume designer. I'm interested in the story of a sound designer. I'm interested in the story of that lighting designer. I'm interested in how they tell their story and motivate things rather than reacting. Yeah, that's what I want to see. So I saw Afterlife at the National, which was design-led by Bunny Christie. And that was, you know, that's a different way of telling a story. And I was, oh yeah, what if we had similar things but other design languages? What does that do?
I guess we kind of come to the part of the episode now, Nicola, where we kind of focus a little bit more on some of our audience listeners that might be having sat through this and thinking, wow, that's really cool. This is this new thing that I didn't really know of before listening to this episode. This sounds so cool. So what advice would you actually have for people that's either early career or just starting out specifically in sound design, or people that might be a few years earlier than that even, in fact, that have gone, I really like theatre, I play some music potentially, how do I take that to the next step to actually start a potential career in this field?
Firstly, wonderful listening so far. I talk a lot. thanks very much. But also, yeah, I stumbled into theatre sound design. I stumbled into it because I was chasing some other dream, and then I am stuck here. I'm not stuck here. I mean, I'm really, truly enjoying every moment of this. I think if this is something that in the back of your head you kind of want to try, you are already... The only thing to do is like just keep listening and to keep reading and keep consuming. A lot of the time I feel like my job is to translate something that is in one way of understanding, in one language, into something that's universal, which is, you know, I don't, when I write music for Scene Change, I don't look at the keyboard and go, I know what I want to write. I just sort of plonk my hands there. I want to understand how each chord makes me feel. Mm. And that is, I think that's just a result of reading the script and then hearing it, being like, okay, well, this makes me feel like that, and then going from there and then looping things or stuff like that. So practical advice is just to keep watching and to keep reading and to keep consuming and keep listening. Mainly just keep listening, go outside and listening to just things. And why do things make you feel like this? Or why does this film make you feel like this? And what are the elements in the design elements in there? Is it the lighting? Is it the grading? Is it the music? What is it in there that's helping contribute to that? And then absorb that as a tool for you to tell stories again. And then the practical bit is to create a demo reel. If this is something that is something, I think a lot of the time when people look for creatives they want to work with, they just need to see samples. So have a SoundCloud, a Bandcamp of different of playlists of different areas. So your sound design show reel could be just two tracks of what you've done with a recording of a dog and you've reversed it and you've done something to it. You have a theater reel, might just be two Scene Change tracks. You may have a film reel, which may be a few tracks of music that you've written in the genre that you love the most. Mm. Practically, my experience is quite London based, because I've been based in London for the past 7 years. Festivals are really great for footfall if you want to get your work out there, because people will be there and they'll want to watch work, and you get to watch work and network afterwards. So that's really practical. It's trying to, you know, there'll be a lot of people looking for designers when festivals like Vault Festival or Edinburgh Festival happens. So keep an eye out for those. And this is going to be slightly controversial, but I think hopefully you'll be in a place in your career where you feel like maybe if you didn't go to drama school, sound design school won't hold you back, because you are a unique creative. And every single of your life experiences sort of leads you to the way you make things. Mm. And so, yeah, obviously you think of the advantages and go for it if this is for you, but if it's not for you, if that's not for you and you want to come back to revisit that later, or want to revisit the career in sound design through different means, it absolutely is doable and for you, I think.
You said something very interesting, sort of just consume as much as you can. And one thing that I found very helpful is in this age of COVID, obviously where everything physical shut down, live venues couldn't continue, there was still such a vast pool, which I think is arguably more beneficial for people like sound designers, writers, composers, actors as well, to some respect. But having audio dramas and podcasts and having the access to these things that are free for the most part is a really good way to just consume as much exciting media as you can. You can just sit in the kitchen and do nothing, to have it on, or maybe cook a meal and it will still be on, and you don't have to sit down and dedicate your entire time to it, but you can still consume as much as you can. It's a really good way to, I don't know, get as much of that osmosis of creativity as you can.
And that's like storytelling as well, you know. I love that throughout the past year we've opened this avenue of storytelling and people being able to feel like their voices are heard, and I hope that we continue that. I agree. And also it's accessible and it's free and it's important.
Yeah, because even when things start opening up again, it is difficult. I mean, neither Luke nor myself live in London. getting to London to watch a show is very much an occasion for us, and it requires a bit of saving in order to do it. You got to get your tickets and you got to get your train, and just having something you can access at home is really, really, really great and accessible. So we always finish on a similar sort of vein of question, but if you had to look back at your entire career in theatre, and this doesn't necessarily mean anything you've worked on, but it could be something you've gone to see, something you've sort of just encountered in any way, shape or form, what is your fondest memory or experience in theatre?
I think it is watching shows with people around me and feeling like the show is saying more than I could ever tell them. You know, I Want to Be Yours by Zia Ahmed at the Bush Theatre was a phenomenal piece for me, because there's so much in there that I struggle to say I'm in an interracial relationship at the moment. So I just can't articulate into words, and yet this thing on stage with a partner beside me, like this thing on stage is there's so much in here that I really want to say and I can't say. Or with a friend beside me, and we might be watching a show about growing up in Hong Kong or things like that, or doing a show together about growing up. But those are the most memorable moments for me. So I can't really pick one, if that's okay.
But
mainly just watching shows where everything on stage that you hear and see and experience encapsulates all the things that you just don't have the words for, and yet the magic of theatre does for you. And the other thing is sometimes walking away from theatre humming the tune, because that's really great. I love watching a show, and then there's somehow in there was a tune that was so catchy that I leave, and that for me is a success. Or watching a show where they just keep putting all these tricks out, and like, what you can't do, oh my god, there's a revolve, okay, great, and then there's a staircase, oh fantastic, oh my god, then there's magic, oh yeah, great. So yeah, the tricks just keep coming. Oh, well, that's a really good question. I really have to think about it.
But that's a really good answer, to be fair. That's a very good answer.
The crux is I don't have the words for it, and yet things that I'm watching have. Yeah. They're doing it for me, and that just keeps me going, and it makes me want to do this a lot more, because somewhere in the audience, someone is also feeling the same, and I know this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a fantastic answer.
Yes. And deep down, that really is the definition of what art and entertainment is, isn't it? It's that ability to say something in a way that for which you don't have the words to say. But to round off the episode, then, Nicola, on this part of the episode, where can people follow you and keep up to date with your work? Or is there anything that you're up to at the moment that you'd quite like to plug?
Not plugging very much. You can find me on, my handles are Nicola T. Chang. That's NicolaTChang. My website's also www.nicolatchang.com. So yeah, at Nicola T. Chang, you can just find me and my work there. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to us. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute joy. And we wish you the best of luck with everything coming up.
Thank you so much. You too. Wishing you both the best. Thanks for having me. It's been lovely.
Thank you.
Lovely Tuesday afternoon.
So that marks the end of this episode of the Talking Theatre podcast, and a massive thank you to Nicola for taking the time to speak with us today. And we was excited before the episode started to delve into this world, and I think we're even more excited to go and explore it after.
It's definitely something that's always piqued my interest in sound design and so on, in the work I've done myself, and just hearing everything she was saying about it. And I've had a very, very good time this episode. I thoroughly enjoyed myself, and just hearing that often sort of designers are overlooked in certain rooms, but having the ability to sort of make your voice heard wherever you can and really bring to a creative process is it's fantastic. And had a great time.
Absolutely. And we hope that you have too. And if you have enjoyed the episode, then be sure to rate and subscribe to us, and even tell your friends about it. The more lovers of theatre we can reach, the better, really.
Yeah, and you can follow whatever it is we're currently doing on Twitter and Instagram at the Talking Theatre Podcast. And as well as that, if you're interested in coming on for an episode and talking about theatre with us, then you can email us at thetalkingtheatrepodcast@gmail.com, and we will reply as soon as we can.
Exactly. So all that's left to say is thank you again for listening to this episode. We hope to see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.